Thank you. First, just one comment on my bio. You probably shouldn't believe everything you read on Wikipedia, but you can check out American Affairs online or in print if you're interested. As I understand, the name of this panel is America in the World, which seems to me like an open invitation to make broad, sweeping, and oversimplified generalizations. So I will try not to disappoint. In one sentence, my view is that the United States, over the last several decades, has constructed a political economy that prioritizes inflating financial assets, while most of the world, and most importantly China, has focused on developing and expanding their industrial base. Trade is an important part of this, though it's far from the only issue, and it cannot be separated from the larger context. Furthermore, it is increasingly evident that the U.S. strategy has sacrificed long-term productive capacities and even national security interests for short-term financial gains. To understand this, I think it is necessary to attempt a brief history of how we got here. Simply put, when the New Deal and Bretton Woods order began breaking down, the United States pursued a strategy of allocating more capital to the corporate sector and prioritizing shareholder returns. The overall trajectory of U.S. policy was to facilitate a shift of capital that, under the New Deal order, would have gone to labor or public spending and allow it to remain in the corporate sector and financial markets under the presumption that they would invest it and create a virtuous cycle of growth. Trade eventually becomes a part of this strategy, but it doesn't happen overnight. Typically, Reagan is identified as the principal actor of this new policy agenda. And the Reagan administration, of course, cut taxes and in various ways accelerated trends toward deunionization and the like. On the other hand, however, Reagan increased federal research spending significantly, and his Defense Department even drew up plans for an ambitious industrial policy, though that was never implemented. On trade, by today's standards, I think Reagan would have to be called a protectionist. He negotiated the Plaza Accords on currencies, he negotiated voluntary import quotas with Japan and other countries, and he imposed tariffs from time to time. It's not until the Clinton and Bush administrations that our current economic order really takes shape. Trade was radically liberalized, first with NAFTA and most significantly with Chinese accession to the WTO. Finance was deregulated, government research budgets were cut significantly, and overall discretionary spending fell as a percentage of GDP. The end of the Cold War almost certainly had an effect on this. The Reagan era, in some sense, represented a reassertion of political competition, with some of that translating into defense-driven economic competition in various technology sectors, despite the rhetoric about free markets. But amidst the end of history euphoria after the Cold War, there was a sense that competition was over, whether ideological, political, or economic. To the extent any economic strategy was thought to be required at all, it was the notion that greater integration between China and the U.S. would say, make China more liberal politically, or that economic shock therapy would bring democracy to Russia. I don't think it's particularly controversial at this point to say that those hopes were not realized, but what has happened to the U.S. domestic economy seems less understood. Instead of the unprecedented growth expected in the 90s, we had two lost decades punctuated by a financial crisis, a narrowing of economic opportunity into a decreasing number of sectors and regions, and declining capacity for productivity growth and innovation. During this time, however, corporate profits as a percent of GDP have soared and are currently at levels higher than at any time since before 2000. Yet although corporate profits are high and corporate debt is also higher than ever and taxes are very low, private sector investment and capital formation are historically very weak. Corporate R&D has kept pace with GDP, but government R&D has fallen by around half. Thus, instead of greater corporate profits leading to more investment and a virtuous cycle of growth, we ended up with more financial engineering and higher asset prices, but not much else. As one recent MIT study concluded, from the beginning of 1989 to the end of 2017, $23 trillion of real equity wealth was created by the non-financial corporate sector. We estimate that 54% of this increase was attributable to the reallocation of rents to shareholders in a decelerating economy. Economic growth accounts for just 24%, followed by lower interest rates and lower risk premium. From 1952 to 1988, less than half as much equity wealth was created, but economic growth accounted for 92% of it. What does this have to do with trade? In short, U.S. trade policy is a major factor that has enabled this increase in corporate profits and shareholder rents without the usually required increase in investment, productivity, and overall economic growth. Asian economies, and especially China in recent decades, have consciously pursued industrial policies aimed at expanding into more and higher value industries. Initially, this may have been a matter of simply taking advantage of lower labor costs and combining that with advanced foreign production techniques, but this strategy also involves subsidizing manufacturing and capital-intensive sectors. These countries also approach trade in a fundamentally different way, requiring local partnerships, technology transfers, and so on, and in some cases outright IP theft, with the explicit goal of building domestic industries and moving higher up the value chain. This exacerbated the effects of existing financial market incentives in the United States, where in general any capital intensity is viewed as an obstacle to high returns and manufacturing is seen only as a cost center. Thus, companies eagerly offshored manufacturing and anything else they could. The thinking was that, in addition to passing some cost savings on to consumers, the corporate sector would reinvest the increased profits from cost savings into higher value activities. But this never happened, at least not anywhere near the scale necessary for it to work. Instead, more and more sectors in the U.S. were being rendered uncompetitive in the process, while the networks necessary for innovation in those sectors dwindled, which further reduced opportunities for investment and intensified unproductive financialization. A shocking number of high-value industries have left the United States. To name just a few, ultra-heavy forgings, which is notable for a number of defense applications such as nuclear reactors, machine tools, permanent magnet electric motors, rare earth element purification, and device fabrication, rechargeable batteries, LED manufacturing, semiconductor foundries, liquid crystal displays, precision glass, fiber optics components including laser diodes, photovoltaic cells, drone hardware. One could go on and on. The conventional narrative around this began with, well, we will shed low-value manufacturing but do high-value manufacturing. Then as more high-end industries left the U.S. and advanced technology imports increased, it was, well, we won't do manufacturing anymore but design and innovation. Except more and more R&D, including R&D funded by U.S. companies, in many industries is going to where the manufacturing is. And losing manufacturing means losing process innovation capabilities. Another study shows that U.S. firms cut R&D and process innovation by about 25% after the institutional framework for trade with China was formalized. I think we may have finally reached the point now where it is no longer possible to tell comforting lies to ourselves. China won the race to 5G. Well, the U.S. has embarrassed itself trying to persuade other countries not to buy Huawei components without being able to offer any competitor to Huawei. And China is a peer competitor in other dual-use technologies such as quantum computing and AI. They are increasingly pushing into sectors where, just a few years ago, U.S. dominance was taken for granted, such as advanced biotech areas like bioengineering and gene editing. The China 2025 program sets out a plan to create national champions in most advanced industries and lays out quotas for domestic purchases to support these efforts. The idea that the U.S. will be a leading exporter of high-end products in the future is thus fanciful for two reasons. First, we make a shrinking number of those exports, and second, China has publicly said that they do not plan to buy them from us and plan to use their own domestic producers, even if we still did produce them. Even the U.S. military is finding it difficult to source necessary materials outside of China, whether for submarines, aircraft, medicine, electrical components, etc. Meanwhile, Boeing, a champion in an industry once thought to be a safe U.S. exporter, has instead offered a perfect symbol of America's industrial decline. Over the last few years, Boeing outsourced major design functions to Japan, it outsourced computer programming to India, and instead of designing a better plane, or even a plane that could fly safely, it took these cost savings and did more than $40 billion worth of share buybacks. Apple, supposedly the paragon of design here, manufacture there, now seems to be focused mainly on designing a credit card and gimmicky pricing strategies, while it continues to lose market share to Chinese and Korean competitors. As for the other big Silicon Valley companies, although they are insulated from investment dynamics given low capital intensity, their dominance relies on a favorable political environment. Perhaps not surprising that by their own admission, they function more like governments than businesses. It is also not surprising that Google, Facebook, and Amazon are trivial players in China and Russia, despite doing everything in their power to accommodate the former. And as China brings more of the world into its orbit through One Belt, One Road, and more countries become reliant on Huawei telecom components, it is not out of the question that Alibaba and other Chinese internet companies could vie for global dominance. In sum, the end point of this trajectory would seem to be the paradigmatic banana republic economy. Reliance on natural resources extraction, low value-added services, and maybe a layer of finance and entertainment. A hollowed-out middle class and dysfunctional politics. This is increasingly recognized, but there was never a plan B to the end of history, and no consensus has yet emerged on how to navigate the new reality. Recently, redistribution programs tend to get the most attention, but regardless of one's opinion on those, for the most part, they do not directly address the productivity and investment issues. The other response, whose most important champion is probably President Trump, has focused on tariffs. Although I have no ideological or categorical objection to tariffs, I think a strategy relying solely on such measures is unlikely to work and is easy to retaliate against. It also does not address the domestic investment issue. The U.S. industrial base for advanced technology products at this point is generally so far behind what exists in Asia, much less automated, older, lower quality, worse infrastructure, and lacking the right skills base and so on, that it is difficult to see tariffs alone moving any of that back to the U.S. or encouraging domestic investment. If we were to, say, set up an American 5G component manufacturer, it would probably make sense to protect that, at least initially. But right now, any sort of strategy of that kind is lacking. The more promising alternative, in my view, would be to proactively direct more investment into strategic sectors, actively encourage domestic economic development, and actually participate in global economic competition. Part of this would simply involve changing market incentives. A lot of different policy decisions went into creating Silicon Valley, for example. We need to think in these terms in addressing other sectors. A recent study examined 150 hardware startups coming out of MIT. These businesses were able to attract early-stage venture capital and create prototypes and pilot production facilities. But when it came time to scale up, these firms could not raise the required capital in the United States. Most of them moved their production to Asia, where financing was available. We thus have a glut of capital chasing the next photo-sharing app because the lack of physical investment looks good in investment models, but a dearth of funding available for hardware innovations. At the very least, programs such as the Small Business Investment Company and SBIR could be updated to address this. In other cases, more direct state intervention is necessary. The most obvious is increasing research funding, but even that is no longer as straightforward as it sounds, given that we have, in many cases, lost the capacity to develop research breakthroughs and translate them into production. Most of the commercial research labs, such as Bell Labs and RCA Labs, which played important roles in the past, now no longer exist in this country. So a more involved approach may be necessary, such as government-funded research institutes taking the place of the old corporate labs. At the most aggressive level in sectors with clear security implications, we will need to consider things like directly supporting the formation of, for example, a domestic 5G components company. The United States has done this before, and we can do it again. There's also no reason why we cannot do what others routinely do, such as require local partnerships or technology transfers for access to our markets. Our trade policy should reflect our industrial strategy. I would argue that this is best achieved through local content requirements and other measures to prioritize domestic production in strategic sectors. The main point, though, is that trade policy should be thought of as a means and not an end in itself. Since the 90s, there has been an ideological aversion to any kind of industrial strategy, but this is completely misguided. It is not a question of having an industrial policy or not. It is a question of consciously pursuing our own economic interests or having our economy shaped to our disadvantage by the industrial policies of others. Thank you.